Welcome to Phantom Podcast Network's Couch Potato Theater. This is Maximum Couch Potato, a special look at the Mad Max franchise, the Australian wasteland fantasy epic series, with, of course, the iconic character, the one, the only, Mad Max. We've looked at Mad Max, the 1979 epic, starring, of course, Mel Gibson as the wandering main force patrol officer, who, of course, exacts revenge for the death of his family. Then, of course, we looked at the amazing western-themed The Road Warrior, known out in Australia as Mad Max 2. And now we look at Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, and joining me is the co-founders of this amazing channel, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel and Kyle Wagner, here to chat Mad Max. The Phantom Podcast Network's Couch Potato Theater proudly presents Maximum Couch Potato, Mac Max Beyond Thunderdome Retrospective, live on the Phantom Podcast Network. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, the Australian correspondent of Fantha Tracks, the Fantha from Down Under Podcast, and more. I'm joined by co-founding members of the Phantom Podcast Network, so please help me welcome here today, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel, and, of course, the amazing Kyle Wagner.
Never gets old, man. Good to be on. Kyle, welcome too, man.
I've just been out in the wasteland. It's a little ugly out there, so I'm glad to come in, take dust a little things off, avoid some mutants, the Master Blaster, all that. I'm ready to do a fun podcast.
I'm gonna make you. You're gonna have to address the wheel, and we're gonna spin it and see what happens to you.
As long as I don't have to wear a pig's head, we're good.
Three men enter, one man leaves. That's right, this is Thunderdome. But before we get into it, Phantom Podcast Network contact info. How can we find out about this amazing channel? Kevin, give us a favor.
Appreciate it, man. You can find all of our great shows, including this one, the Couch Potato Theater of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, on fpnet.podbean.com. That is our master feed there at the Phantom Podcast Network. FPNet is also on the Podbean app. Phantom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play for your Android users. We're also on Facebook under Phantom Podcast Network. You can email us at phantompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. We are also on Instagram at Phantom Podcast Network and on Twitter at FanPod Network. Adam, where can we find you on Instagram and Twitter?
You can find me under Obi Pop Culture on both of those areas. You can also catch us on the site of fanthatracks.com. You can catch my show every Saturday. That's right, every Saturday, or is it every Friday in the US? I don't know. I keep forgetting the time difference. That's right. For all your Star Wars fun with a bit of a Vegemite touch, can we say? That's right. We love it out here in Australia too. You can catch the Phantha from Down Under every Saturday on there. Kyle, where can we catch you?
You can find me on Twitter at AKyleW or on Instagram at AKylePhantom. And Kevin, you didn't say anything about time travel here. I didn't think I was doing Type 40 today.
Hey man, you got to be prepared. I'm Kevin. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix. And also, you can support the Phantom Podcast Network on TeePublic. If you want a cool t-shirt, head on over to TeePublic, search Phantom Podcast Network, and you'll find some great logos of all of these shows across the board for your t-shirts, whatever you want, cups. It's awesome. Even this cool tapestry I have hanging behind me. Also, please head on over to iTunes, search Phantom Podcast Network. And if you like what you're hearing here on Couch Potato Theater, this Maximum Couch Potato, head on over there. Please leave us a review. Search Phantom Podcast Network when you do.
All right. So welcome back to everybody that's joined today. If you've just come on for the first time, you're a Mad Max fan, well, this is the place to go. But we've also covered the first two films. So just quickly, 1979's Mad Max, the original film, was covered a few months ago. And I've got to say, it's one of my favorite films. And I hope you all go back and have a look at that episode and have a look at our insight, because we all really got into it, particularly Kevin and I got to the deep core of what makes it so special. Then, of course, Mad Max 2, or as Kevin likes to put it, The Road Warrior.
That's how Americans knew it.
And of course, Kyle, you joined us on that one, and that was a fantastic episode. And a little bit look at what made that special for you guys coming in. That was your first film for this franchise, to really get a grip of what this Wasteland franchise is all about. And of course, you got Mel Gibson, fresh from Australia, going, "Get out of my hair, gal," to, "Hi, how are you? I'm back here in America. Let's do Lethal Weapon."
Now, wait a minute, guys. I still haven't got my hockey mask back from that episode, by the way. I want to know what Adam has been doing with it.
Okay, Mr. Humongous.
But today we're here to talk about, of course, the third film, which is the bigger budget one. This is the family-friendly version of the Mad Max film to a certain extent. And, of course, this is a much bigger film. The others, a little bit more commercial, I think, is the thing, because there was a lot of international money put into this. So we'll get into a lot of that very soon. We're digging down deep to find what makes it special and unique among the franchise itself. And a natural progression, of course, gets us to the next episode, which will be covering the big one, the biggest film of 2015, Fury Road. That's right. So as we get into it, you can find links as we go through. We'll be giving you some to go and check out, whether it's on IMDb, YouTube, vice versa. We talk about some of the great trailers. We're going to look at reviews, poster art, cast information, and, of course, our own feelings about this amazing film. So if you want to have a look at Mad Max Beyond Thunder Mountain's original trailers, et cetera, you can check it out on IMDb at imdb.com title, and then we'll put these up in the show notes for you, where it'll actually cover some of the amazing stuff. But let's talk about the poster art first, guys. And this was done by an artist by the name of Richard Amsell. So, Kevin, tell me about your thoughts on this amazing, beautiful art that we've seen everywhere on the VHS cover.
Well, what's interesting about this art is it's very detailed and lifelike. But what I also liked about it was there wasn't a lot of other alternate art, you know, done for this movie. There was pretty much just one, maybe different sizes. Maybe they had banner size posters, but you had Mad Max there front and center with the children below him. And then, of course, Tina Turner behind him. But Richard Amsell, he was an American illustrator and graphic designer. His career was brief but prolific. He did a lot of movie posters, album covers, and magazine covers. His portrait of comedian Lily Tomlin for the cover of Time is now part of the permanent collection of the Smithsonian Institute. And he's also associated with TV Guide for 13 years. For American fans, TV Guide, and it's still around, but TV Guide was the thing that everybody got to figure out what was happening in television in the next week or so. And it was kind of like an entertainment magazine too, like an Entertainment Weekly, but in TV Guide, a lot of great articles. And it was a little bit smaller size. It wasn't magazine size. And my dad used to get it every year. And they had some great original art on there. And Richard Amsell was one of the artists that did a lot of them. Unfortunately, Richard passed away. This was his last project that he worked on. Says here that he passed away on November 17th, 1985, and this was released in 1985. When it comes to artists, he may not be a household name to a lot of people, but I'm sure that you've seen his work. And this poster, I got to say, is a beautiful poster. What do you think, Kyle?
Oh, this was a breathtaking poster. I remember seeing this in the theaters and just being instantly drawn to it. You know, you have Mel Gibson front and center on this poster, who at the time Mad Max came out, he was really kind of getting notoriety, but he still wasn't fully Mel Gibson as we know him. The big selling point on this was Tina Turner. And you have Tina Turner taking up most of the background, very eye-catching. And just everything about this poster is just like, what is this? What I'm very curious about, what is Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome? Because a lot of people at the time didn't necessarily make the initial connection between Mad Max and the Road Warrior, even when this came out. They were, and then once the connection was made, that's when a lot of people really started getting very excited about this film in the States.
I think you got a really big point there. One of the things we saw out here in Australia before this really took off was, do you guys remember Mad Magazine?
Mm-hmm. Very popular over here.
Absolutely.
Right. So Mad Magazine did a caricature of this art for one of their covers out here in Australia. And that's what really got me. I knew Mad Max because my father was a big fan of the first two films. But my father wasn't a big fan of this film. And he sort of went, look, they've got it on the shelves in the newsagents where we find a lot of those Mad Magazines. And I picked that up, and then that's when I found this on VHS. So I didn't see it till much later than it was on the theatrical release. But the actual cover was what got me. The Australian VHS cover was this beautiful sandblasted art that was just straight away giving you a sense of the desperation, the desolation, and, of course, the vivid, fantastical imagery of the wasteland.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely iconic, and just the color palette of it, too, just really makes it pop.
Really does. And we're seeing the themes there. Obviously, Aunt Entity being one of the big themes, which we'll get into a little bit later. Mad Max himself, you know, this is his, almost like, it feels like his final journey. Well, for us, it was Mel Gibson's in that role. But also we're starting to see the children that are caught in the middle of the wasteland as well. So I think there's, what do you think, Kyle and Kevin, go your thoughts. Do you think this is telling the story of the film through the art?
I think it is. It definitely, I think, encapsulates what you're going to be getting out of this film. And of course, towards, you know, down at the bottom near where it says Mel Gibson, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, you see some vehicles that, of course, is legendary with Mad Max films. You got to have some type of, you know, road desert vehicles doing something.
Yeah, no, and I agree with Kevin. It's a perfect encapsulation of what Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome was about. It hit all the high marks of Mad Max. It's got that look. It's got that feel. And, you know, the artistry on this poster is just so amazing. I mean, Mel Gibson in this portrait looks so spot on. And even Tina Turner, who has that unique look and just stands out. And this poster just did a great job of selling what this movie was.
It really did. Now, we're going to get into the plot of the film, but just a quick backstory on Mad Max. For those that may not know it and you're listening to this podcast for the first time, so the 1979 film is set in the near future. We get Mad Max, who is a main force patrol police officer, gets involved in some of the bikie gangs and retribution and, of course, revenge as his wife is killed by none other than Toe Cutter, the leader of these gangs. And once he finds revenge, he basically becomes a Ronin, a wandering lone gunman, if you like, or gunslinger out in the Old West, very much a samurai in the wasteland. And we see him 5 years later going toe-to-toe between two rival factions over gasoline. And that is, of course, the events of Road Warrior or Mad Max 2. Now, this film that we're about to talk about is set 15 years after that, so 20 years after the first film. So about 15 years after the events of Mad Max 2, nuclear war has finally destroyed what little is left of civilization. Grizzled and older, the former main force patrol officer Mad Max, played by Mel Gibson, roams the Australian desert in a camel-drawn vehicle until father and son thieves Jebediah Sr., which is played by the amazing and iconic Bruce Spence, and Jr., played by Adam Cockburn, use their jury-rigged airplane to steal possessions and means of transportation. But Max soon winds up in Bartertown, a cesspool of a post-apocalyptic capitalism powered by methane-rich pig manure. That's poo. And two competing overlords. Now, this is where the film really takes in, and we're going to talk about very soon. It's played by Tina Turner's Aunt Entity, which is such a brilliant role. And, of course, Master, played by Angelo Rosito, a crafty midget who also rides around on the back of his hulking underling, Blaster, played by Paul Larson. Now, Paul Larson, which we'll get into a little bit later, is in every single Mad Max film. This is something that repeats in the other films, is that there's recurring roles. We'll get into that a little bit later. Seeking to re-equip himself, Mad Max strikes a deal with a haughty auntie to kill Blaster in ritualized combat inside Thunderdome, a giant jungle gym where Bartertown's conflicts are played out in a postmodern update of blood and circuses. Basically, Gladiator. Although Max manages to tell the mighty Blaster he refuses to kill after realizing the brute is actually a mentally impaired boy. Auntie's henchmen murder Blaster nonetheless, then punish Max for violating the law. Two men enter, one man leaves. Lashed to the back of a hapless pack animal and set out into the sandstorm, a near-death Max is rescued by a band of tribal children and teens. Ewoks. Descendants of the victims of an airplane crash, the kids inhabit a lush valley and wait for the day when Captain Walker, the plane's pilot, will return to lead them back to civilization. Some of the children refusing to believe that Max isn't Walker and that the glorious cities on their mythology no longer exist, set off in search of civilization on their own. Max and three tribe members must then rescue their friends from Border Town and the clutches of Aunt Entity, a quest that ends in a lengthy desert chase sequence and echoes the original films. So, what do you think of the plot first, boys, before we get into the details?
There's several things that I liked about the plot that I think really lent to the world building of Mad Max. Because, and I remember our friend Macca said this, I think in the, I think it was in the second episode with Road Warrior, where Mad Max isn't really the character. You know, it's the aftermath of what happened. It's the people that make this film. That's the universe that Mad Max is best at showing. And I thought that did a good job visually. The plot, I think that where it kind of throws people off and honestly, for me, takes a wrong turn. The first half really works for me, but the second half with the children, the Lost Boys type Peter Pan slash type thing, that's where I think most fans kind of lost it a little bit. I know where they were trying to go with it, but also too, I think what saves this film is the first half of it, really, and especially Tina Turner and the Thunderdome. The Thunderdome is really, really cool for obvious reasons, and we'll get into that later. But the plot wise, I felt that it did falter in the latter half of the film. I don't think that's what true Mad Max, Road Warrior, Mad Max 2 fans really wanted to see out of a Mad Max film. I think they wanted to see something a little more intense, less family friendly, something a little more gritty. So that's my take on the plot. What about you, Kyle?
You know, I agree with a lot of what you said. I think one of the things that hurt this movie was the first half is outstanding. But the second half, once you get in with the children and you kind of get this family thing going and you kind of get like the humanity coming back to Max a little bit, being exposed to these children, it felt like that the movie just got quagmired in that second half of this plot and that it just really slowed down after such a great start. And I think it really took a lot of the edge away, which was a big key in the first two Mad Max films, was the edge of those films. And it kind of picks up again towards the end when you have the desert chase and you got to get back to that Mad Max feel. But it's just in that time period from about the time where Max is sentenced for his crime until he kind of has to go back and actually rescue these children, that this movie just kind of bogs down in the plot. And that's what I remember always, especially seeing this film and even going back and rewatching it. It just feels like all of a sudden you're going from 100 miles an hour to trudging through 10 miles an hour of mud.
It really is. I think it feels like, to me, a fast-paced adventure flick that hits a brick wall. And it hits a brick wall pretty fast, and all you hear is yub-nub. I mean, that's really, to me, what I get out of it. And I don't mean that as a joke. I mean that it really is a time where you've had films like Return of the Jedi, E.T., a lot of successful kids' films or children's and family films, which have, you think about Australia at the time, we weren't huge. When it came to films, we had Gallipoli. We had Mad Max, and we had The Man from Snowy River. That was pretty much it in the international market. So, for directors like, of course, George Miller and his hired help on the film, George Ogilvy, those two really had to come to terms with how do we make this bigger? How do we make it more accessible to an audience? And I think that's one of the things that really drove the writers Terry Hayes and George Miller to do. But there's some underlying themes why the film is a little bit disjointed, because of some events which happened just before the film, unfortunately, to some of the creators of the franchise. We'll get into that very soon. So the film has a runtime of 1 hour and 47 minutes and country region Australia, and the vice versa on Blu-ray or DVD in your own neck of the woods, whether that's a different runtime. Sometimes in the States, you guys have a different runtime.
It's true. Yeah, it depends too on the film and the violent content, if any. You know, they will alter films. That has been known to happen, just like they did with Mad Max and Road Warrior.
That's right. And Blade Runner too, I believe. You guys had a
Yep.
A couple of punches, a couple of this, a couple of that, you know, that were removed, I think, from that film. The language in the film is, of course, English, and, of course, release date was the 10th of July, 1985 in the USA. I think you guys got first release.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, I think this was much more marketed as an American movie as it was more than an international movie, in this case, this particular Mad Max film.
Yeah, there's a lot of international money pumped into this film via, I guess, the American production company behind it, with Warner Brothers really coming to the fore. Because Warner Brothers obviously distributed the last film, and I think they're so successful internationally, they said, well, look, we're just going to bankroll this and really get right into it. The film is titled Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And unlike the previous film, this is the not only international, but across the board, this is the film's title only. So you don't get any Road Warrior on this one. the film was shot in far northern South Australia. Again, this is a slightly different location. And I might put some, I'll put obviously some stuff up about this in the show notes for you guys to check out when the episode releases. But there are different parts of Australia that these films were shot in. The first film was shot actually in Melbourne, so in and around Victoria. The second film was shot in New South Wales, right on the far border heading towards South Australia. And then this film shot in South Australia. So completely different areas, but it does look the same.
I do, when I was doing the rewatch of this, the one scene that I really, really enjoyed was the tribal children's home they called The Crack in the Earth. It was filmed in Mermaid's Cave, Blue Mountains, New South Wales, Australia. Have you ever been in that area before, Adam?
I had my parents actually owned a house not far from there in the Blue Mountains when they first got married.
Oh, wow. Because it's actually a beautiful shot location, and it makes you kind of want to go there and visit. And it's just one of those things about watching these films being filmed in Australia that really captured the Americans' audience imagination, especially with Crocodile Dundee and watching these Mad Max films. This scenes like this, I mean, when you see a scene like Bartertown, you don't necessarily want to go to Bartertown because of the people that are there. But when they do a shot like this, you go, wow, I really want to check this out.
Blue Mountains is very much, I think, very similar to when we've seen some of the John Ford Westerns. And you see those sort of the red mountains that you see out in the desert. They're beautiful locations, hazardous locations because of where their proximity are, height. Blue Mountains is the same. Beautiful dividing range of mountains and stuff like that. But they're very high. And especially my parents, when they were living there, that house sitting on a wall like this, like literally like a 20-degree angle, sheer cliff. So you get these beautiful areas, but, I mean, you can't have any dogs or cats or anything like that because they'll just go for a wander and go, pew!
One thing I noticed, too, is this movie obviously had a much bigger budget. If I remember Mad Max, wasn't it like around $1 million or $2 million?
It was about $300,000.
What's that?
It's only about $300,000 or $400,000. They actually had.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I think it was maybe $1 or $2 million for Mad Max 2. Maybe I think it was. So this one got $10 million. That's pretty good budget for a film like this, I guess.
This is huge, and the opening weekend in the US alone made seven back straight away. It grossed overall in its theatrical run $36 million, which is huge.
It probably made more overseas too, but for US that was the take. And that's a successful film. That's definitely, three times as much as it costs. So, I mean, yeah, that's a good return there.
It certainly is. Now, guys, we're going to go through our reactions. Now, what I want from each of you is when you first saw the film and your immediate reaction at that age or whenever you did see it. So Kevin, let's go with you.
I actually saw this in the theater because I remember not seeing, Mad Max, of course, not in the theater because it did not show in the theater here. And that's why when Road Warrior came out, it was just like, oh, Road Warrior, and that hit VHS. But I remember seeing this in the theater when it came out and being kind of excited for it because I knew what I was in for, because we saw Road Warrior on broadcast television, heavily edited. Then, because of the popularity of Road Warrior, we saw the original Mad Max. So we kept seeing those all on television, heavily edited, of course, with all the gory scenes taken out. Of course, it's tame nowadays, but so I remember seeing this and I was really, really excited about it. I remember coming out of it going, okay, this is fun, but it wasn't as good as I was hoping it would be. But it was nice to see it on the big screen. I do remember myself liking it more than the people that I was with at the time. they were actually a little disappointed, the group that I was with. And I was like, you know, I kind of liked it, you know. And specifically on certain scenes that touched on as I've mentioned, the world building before. And I'll mention specifically as certain scenes later. But that was my first reaction to it. Kyle, what about you?
I actually didn't see this till it came out on VHS. And I remember I was living in Alaska at the time, and this is when the theater in Alaska didn't have maybe but five theaters in it. So it was – things never had a really big run unless it was something huge like a Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones or something like this. This, I think, was only in the theater for about 2 weeks up in Alaska, so I just didn't get a chance to see it in the theaters. I saw it on VHS. I remember my mom actually renting it for me. I was home – sick from school, and she rented me several movies, and this was
have I mentioned how much I like your mom? I swear, his family, his mom, they let him watch the coolest movies. My parents would not let me do that.
Anyway, I remember watching this, and I actually, and part of it was, I think, because I was sick, I was really traced into it for the first half of it, and then I remember literally falling asleep during the time with the kids, and I went back and rewatched it, and it's kind of how I still feel about this movie today. I love the first about 45 minutes, and then it takes a drop off. Now, I appreciate more what's going on with it being older and watching it, but at the time, it just felt like, okay, where's my car chases? Why am I just sitting here watching kids read a book and talk about Captain Walker and feeling like I'm watching scenes from the Blue Lagoon?
And I have to say the same. Like, when I first saw this, I was about probably 10 years old, 12 years old, and I didn't know what I was watching. I thought, is this a TV movie version of Mad Max? Because, yes, it had the budget. Yes, it had the massive sort of visuals that you get in a cinema experience, but I was let down. I didn't understand why all of a sudden we're going from these massive hand-to-hand confrontations in the Thunderdome sequences, and then all of a sudden he's wandering around with a clown's head on him, on a camel's back. I mean, and, you know, it's all these juxtaposition. But as years have grown, the film has grown with me. And I think one of the things that I take away from the film itself is he was influenced heavily as a director by the films that were around at the time. And, of course, I think a lot of the influence from Warner Brothers to make this a commercial film. And as we'll go into a little bit later, something we covered a little bit on Fantatrax is, I think, Return of the Jedi is a heavy-handed influence at the time. First, it's a third film, just like Thunderdome, and there's elements in there which draw in a bigger crowd, a demographic wider, to give it, again, the kind of thing that it needs. But before we get into that, we're going to talk about a little bit about the production itself and some of the things behind the scenes which may have contributed to how this film was made. So the film itself was the first Mad Max film made without producer Byron Kennedy, sadly, who was killed in a helicopter crash in 1983 while location scouting for the third film. While the film was in development before Kennedy's death, George Miller was hesitant to continue without his partner. And he said, I was reluctant to go ahead. And then there was a sort of need to, well, let's just do something to get over the shock and, of course, the time of grieving. So as you can see, and the film itself, a title card at the end of the film says, for Byron. And I think there's a lot of the character of Mad Max himself that was Byron Kennedy. If you watch some of the behind-the-scenes features on the new box sets, which you can get out here in Australia, I think you guys in the US will get it as High Octane Mad Max, it's called. It's a huge set of all four films. And the High Octane edition has a Mad Max behind-the-scenes where they said, well, Byron's just as mad as Max, because he would take the actual car. Now, we're talking about the original car, the MFP car itself, and he would go down and get the bread and milk. He'd be just tearing down those streets. Oh, right. Oh, I got me 2 liter milk, got me bread, got me sausages. He's going to have a barbie. You know, that was the sort of life of this guy. Whereas, of course, George is a little bit more down to earth, calmer individual. And that's where we get that character from, was created by both of them. So the film itself ended up being co-directed by a friend of George's, and that is another George. So you get two Georges for the price of one. George Ogilvie, and whom he had worked together with on a very famous miniseries out here called The Dismissal. And basically, as he says, he had a lot on his plate. He asked his friend who come in and help him out, who worked on that miniseries. And basically the big thing was they were grieving. And at the time, he needed somebody there to help him get through those experiences with the actors, the crew. And I think the big thing to take back from that, when you're grieving, you can't really think and focus on business at hand. Kev, what are your thoughts on Byron Kennedy?
Yeah, I had forgotten about this, to be honest with you, that, you know, the production went through this and being losing a close friend like George Miller did, I can understand that. There is a time for grieving, but I also understand about wanting to stay busy, stay focused on something so you don't run yourself into the ground. And this is something I know that he wanted to finish for his friend as well, because I'm sure his friend would have wanted that. I know going into a production, if I was taken out one way or another, I would know that if wherever I do end up, I would want that production ended. Same thing happened with the production of The Crow when Brandon Lee passed away. You know, they did not want to scrap that film, and his mother and his fiance wanted Brandon's legacy to be there still. And so that's why they got together and finished that film. Similar situation in like this, you know, and so I think it was nice that he actually asked for help. And apparently that worked really well when George was able to concentrate on certain parts of the film and then bring it together and get together. I mean, when you look at the biggest superhero films now, you got two brothers, the Russo brothers, and that's a great team. Those guys know what their each role is to bring a movie like the Avengers Infinity War together.
Definitely. Carl, what are your thoughts?
You know, Kevin, I had forgotten about this, but you know, when I, being reminded about this, it makes me remember something I've always kind of thought about this particular film, and something I've kind of always looked at as the trilogy of the Mad Max series. I've always kind of looked at the first Mad Max being the story of a man who loses his humanity. Road Warrior being kind of the story of that man surviving without his humanity. And really, Beyond Thunderdome, that man kind of finding his humanity again at the end of this. And you know, remembering that Byron was killed in this movie, I think that kind of, before the production of this movie, I think that kind of maybe influenced that feeling more in how George did the movie at that time. And I think you can really see that. And you know, the thing about, I always talk about people with Mad Max, and this particularly Beyond Thunderdome, was this third film has always had a different feel than the other two films, and I think this is a big reason why.
Oh, without a doubt, I think this is the, to put in terms of trilogies, I think this is the Alien 3 of the franchise, or in some ways even on a more commercial level, the Back to the Future Part 3 of the series. Because I always feel that third films can be different, and they need to be their own identity. You know, they need to have that sort of sense of difference, if you like. And this film certainly does that with its locations as well. So the film took place with filming in the mining town of Coober Pedy, very famous mining town area. And that was the set for the actual main exteriors. You see little bits and pieces of the background of Bartertown there. But the actual sets for Bartertown were built in an old brickworks called the Brick Pit. And that is in Homebush Bay in Sydney's western suburbs, which, believe it or not, I was at in about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So there you go, guys. And the children's camp shot was shot, as we talked about earlier, at the Blue Mountains, which is just outside of Sydney. So little bits and pieces of New South Wales, but also South Australia with Coober Pedy, which is also the location of a quite famous and much later produced film, which you might know, starring Vin Diesel.
Which one?
Pitch Black.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Very cool. All right.
Yeah. And so I think a lot of that was, you know, they realized they wanted a certain look as well. And they went back and went, well, hey, Dean Semler shot that on film out here. This is the locations. So you're going to get that beautiful desert sort of look. So Thunderdome proved far more challenging than Road Warrior. Dean Semler is quoted as saying, and he's also said, we were dealing with more varied environments than before. It was essential that each of the worlds looked different. It had its own distinctive look. And I think for the most part, they've really succeeded because it does look different. I mean, we were only talking about that earlier, weren't we, guys, where each film sort of part has its own real feel. It's almost like a different world.
Yeah, that's one thing you got out of this one, because the first two Mad Max film, you have mostly take place either, you know, the first film obviously shows Max's home life, so you get that, but then it's out on the open road. Mad Max 2, Road Warrior, it's out in the open road, and then you have the gasoline town there. And, you know, there really isn't a lot of varying type of surrounding different looking areas that you get in this one. And that's one of the things that works for this film. Bartertown is great. It's one of the best sets I think that a lot of movies have done at that time and still rivals a lot of stuff that you see now. And then of course where the kids are too, great area as well. So you get a lot of different looks at what the wasteland or after the apocalypse looks like. And I think that was something that is definitely one of the things that is a highlight for this film.
Certainly is. Cool thoughts?
I agree with a lot what Kevin said, and it's something that I always go back to with all of the Mad Max films. You know, I think when we take a visual in our mind's eye of post-apocalyptic, we all go to that Mad Max type world. And I think it's because that the visual of all of the Mad Max films just is what we've always thought about. And they did such a great job at executing it. And you look at, especially in Thunderdome, I think more than any of the other films, you have the amazing look of Bartertown and the Thunderdome. Yet you go to this beautiful lush area in the Blue Mountains and you have that contrast of like this death area, but then you have this area where there's life and where these children are. And I think it works so well for this film as far as the locations and them being so contrastingly different. And I think that's one of the things that worked out of that changeover that happens in this film.
I agree. And I think some of the audiences certainly agree with that sort of sentiments. As we get into that, we're going to also look at the critical reaction of the film itself. So it's generally positive, although the reviewers disagreed as whether they considered it the highest or lowest point of the Mad Max trilogy itself. Most of them thought there was a, obviously the production was a huge value. Lots of money put in the right places to get those stunts and everything looking exactly as they needed. But the biggest criticism is one we've talked about a little bit earlier, and that is heavily derivative of Lost Boys and, of course, Peter Pan. Kevin, take it away.
Yeah, what's interesting about this is when I was looking at these reviews, they were more positive than I actually expected from the critics. Of course, they do touch on the whole Lost Boys, Peter Pan type scenario you get in the last half of the film. The Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome here on currently on Rotten Tomatoes is 75% fresh, but it's only 49% with the audience score. Now, for me personally, in the last, 25 years talking about Mad Max among my peers and my friends, the this film does not hold up well for the people that I'm used to talking to about this film. A lot of people don't like this film. They love quoting from it. They love talking about, you know, the Thunderdome itself, two men enter, one man leave. And there's a lot of iconic images and quotes and stuff like that. But when it comes down to it, it does not hold up and was not a good enough final film to kind of cap this trilogy that people really wanted. And that's more word of mouth, talking with peers and friends of mine. So these reviews, positive reviews, actually caught me off guard a little bit. What do you think, Kyle?
I feel very much the same way because, you know, the thing I look at with this film is this is one of those movies that is part of a very big piece of movie history with Mad Max. It has a very unique place in history, but of this film, this film is about moments and sayings and visuals. Two men enter, one man leave. We've been quoting that since the first time we ever heard that come out of Tina Turner's mouth. You know, it's, you talk to most people who remember this film. They remember that. They remember the Thunderdome fight. They remember the unique and amazing look Tina Turner had in this film. But most people either just kind of blank out about the second half, or they're just like, yeah, it was there. They had these few really cool things, but it just really didn't do much for me. So again, I'm kind of shocked too, but you know what? I can see where the critics and how the critics think sometimes. They probably went for more of the deeper philosophical side of the second half of Thunderdome, while the general audience was more about the action and wanting that classic Mad Max feel to it.
Yeah, and I want to touch real quick. It says that despite most positive reviews from the critics, the fans, who are probably the loudest critics, have criticized this film for being Hollywoodized, you know, having a lighter tone than its predecessors. And fans are smart. When you try to do that, try to make something more commercial, they did that with a lot of part twos and threes. One of my biggest complaints about Revenge of the Nerds 2, same thing, not rated R, not edgy enough, same thing. That when you try to make it a not R or mature and you go for that PG or PG-13 rating, you really sacrifice a lot of what the original films made it unique and wonderful to watch.
Agreed. And Roger Ebert, of course, the famous film critic, said it's the first really original movie idea about how to stage a fight scene since we got the first karate movies. And he gave it 4 out of 4 and later placed the film as one of the 10 best films of 1985. Of course, he's a very opinionated film critic. So he was one that knew what he wanted, knew what he liked. And he's right. It was a very gripping sequence, I think, when in the Thunderdome sequence itself. But again, a lot of it comes down to, of course, the Peter Pan idea that really slows down the film. But let's look at the characters of this amazing franchise, and in particular, this film. We're going to start with Mel Gibson, and of course, played by this amazing actor. We get Mad Max Rokitansky, Mel Gibson in his prime before he went off to work in the States with all of his roles, like, of course, Lethal Weapons, Martin Riggs. We have an actor who plays a former Main Force Patrol officer who's a lone warrior, and Max roves the desert aimlessly, his existence entirely based on self-survival. Your thoughts, Kyle?
Well, you know, I think this was a great role for Mel Gibson, and Mad Max is one of the roles he's legendary for. But I even remember in this film, him not having a lot of dialogue, because yet again, he had such a heavy accent still at the time. And, I think the one line that everybody remembers from Mel Gibson of this film is, "Me Max."
Yeah, that's the only time his name is referenced, which is interesting. I first of all, I loved his look. I loved the fact that he had the long hair for a while anyway. And I thought it was fascinating that you see the deterioration of his machine is now having to be pulled by pack animals as opposed to, you know, fuel, which is now gone probably. All the guzzling is gone, so they're having to find alternative fuel, which is one of the things that they talk about in this film. I thought he looked great. He still had, you know, his Mad Max coat on. But I like the fact that he picked up more things. He had more weapons this time, which I also loved. I love the scene where he's dropping all of his weapons, you know, and what's funny is you only see him drop a few, but then you see his face and you just see him and the sound of him dropping more stuff.
And, of course, the next character that we meet in our journey is Jebediah the Pilot, played by the enigmatic and iconic Bruce Spence. This is a marauding pilot who trades stolen goods in Bartertown. And Spence previously played the character of course, the Gyro Captain in Mad Max 2. Like many other actors, he returned to play another role, not unlike, of course, the Gyro Captain. But this is kind of a reflection of him in that they were having difficulty casting the role. So they thought to themselves, why not bring back Bruce? So, Kev, what are your thoughts?
I like Bruce, and I'm glad they brought him back, even though, you know, he's kind of the same character and he's a pilot. But the fact that he had his son with him, I thought was great. And his son knew how to fly just as much as he did. And they kind of scour the wasteland looking for people that they can, well, knock off their rides and steal their stuff, you know. And I like Bruce. He's a great guy. He's a great character actor. And I love his plane in this film. I'd never seen a plane like that before. And I know that's, I think we'll probably might touch that on that in the trivia, but I just thought that was a great upgrade than from the gyrocopter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I'm with Kevin. I love Bruce Spence, but I have to admit his being cast in this role, which was so similar to the gyro captain. But when the first time I saw this being younger, there was a lot of confusion there. I'm like, oh, it's the same character.
Yeah, I did too. I thought he was too.
And when then realizing, oh wait, it's a totally different character. Cause I was like, oh, well he had the kid with the blonde that he was, you know, that was my initial thinking, the blonde that he was kind of pairing up with at the end of Road Warrior. So I was like, well, it's their kid. And so I it's loved, great to see Bruce on the screen, but I think this was one of those things that was, you know, a source of confusion for a lot of people when they first saw this movie the first time until they got some real clarification on this. And, you know, I understand what they did, but, you know, you kind of was like, maybe if they would have just went with somebody else. But again, I'm not going to complain about Bruce Spence in my film.
Definitely. Now, of course, we talked about Bruce Spence had his son along with him on that one, the character, going through and doing the scene. I thought it was a comedic sort of beat to that too that was quite good, where, the you know, this is how you do it, son. This is how you pillage cars and get all your stuff. Right, which, of course, he took to the barter town, run by Aunt Entity, played by the amazing Tina Turner. So let's talk about the character. She's a ruthless, determined ruler. Entity is a glamorous Amazon-like figure who recognizes the strength of character in Max and hopes to exploit him to gain sole control of Bartertown from Master Blaster. Despite her brutality and Bartertown's chaos, Entity is an intelligent, cultured woman who holds a sort of sense of hope that one day rebuilding society together to get to back to its former glory. I think one of the things is she's a redeeming and positive character, even though in the first, say, half hour, you don't know what to think. What do you reckon, Kev?
I just loved Tina's look in this. It you know, that chainmail thing she had going on. And obviously, American audiences know her as the musician, the singer, and having probably some of the best legs in showbiz. And she still has them, and she's known for that. And I think she actually, there was a thing where she actually had insured her legs. She was very famous for that. But it was great to see her in this role. We were kind of wondering, like, wait a minute, Tina Turner? What's that about? But she commanded every scene that she was in. And, you know, her being a great singer, she was able to project her voice with certain lines, you know, whether it's like, he's a raggedy man, you know, stuff like that, that we still remember today. And you know, two men enter, one man leaves, you know, and the way that she orders people around and that whole first scene between her and Max up in her little, like, I guess you call it a fancy tree house, but not a tree. And, you know, how he beats up her guards and then she holds him off with the crossbow and she goes, you just survived the audition, you know?
Your thoughts, Kyle?
Well, at this, what happened at this film with when this came out was this wasn't Mel Gibson's films in the States. This was Tina Turner's film. This was at maybe the biggest height of her popularity in her career. She was coming off hit after hit after hit. She was completely so recognizable. The minute people saw her, they knew who Tina Turner was. You tie in with, and we'll talk about this more when we talk about the soundtrack, but the hit song that goes along with this film. And Tina Turner she has a presence about her that nobody else has. And it showed on screen so powerful. It makes me wish she would have done more films, but the marketing in the US was all about Tina Turner for this film. And rightfully so, because I think she is by far the most powerful presence in this movie.
I think so too. I'm going to jump down a few characters down to the Master, who's a diminutive former engineer who basically parlays his technical skills into building the methane extractor, which is responsible for the power and obviously the electricity of Bartertown itself. So when the film begins, a little bit like Aunt Entity, you don't really know whether Master's a bad guy or a good guy or vice versa. I think they're very much like businessmen or business leaders. And, you know, they're there for one thing only, to rule their business. So they're not so much an empire. And one of the things I get from both of those is it's so well played. It's not until you actually see the crunching of those together that you really see that both of them are actually good people. He frequently humiliates Entity into acknowledging his power over her. And when Blaster is killed, however, Master becomes a far more subdued and humble and good character, and obviously escapes with the help of Max later. But I think this is one of the great things about the film is there's no real bad guys. So Angelo played it so well. Angelo Rizzito was the actor that played the Master. What are your thoughts, Kyle?
He was great in this role, and you know, you hit it right on the head. There's no bad guy in this film. These are just people trying to survive in whatever way possible in the world that's created for them. And that, you know, there's not a bad person. There's different ways to go about it, and it's by what the society and culture has allowed for at this point. But you know, you see Master Blaster together, and it's a very imposing duo. And then when Blaster is killed in the Thunder, after the Thunderdome, and you see the change in Master, you realize this is just a guy who was doing whatever he could to survive in this world and deal with the hand he was given.
Kevin, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I loved the duo looked cool. You know, you have Blaster, this big imposing guy with his metal helmet over his head, so you're wondering what he looks like. And then he's got this little thing behind him that carries this little man by the name of Master. And Master knows that his role in Bartertown is securing his power, because he's the one, he has power because he's supplying the power. Mm. And I like that kind of shell game that character plays against Tina Turner's character. But I also like, and I agree with you guys to a certain degree about there really is no center bad guy. Everyone is having a part, and it's more about winning. It's about staying alive in this world. But when you see Blaster get killed, when you find out, you know, first of all, what he looks like, when Master is grieving over him, you really feel for the guy. And I really love that portrayal. But of course, that's when he loses his power. And, you know, that's when Tina Turner's character goes, okay, this is my power play now. This is where I'm going to take over. But I just love the look of these guys. And that whole scene in the Thunderdome was just fantastic.
Really was. It was a great role. Now, I'm going to zip through some of these for you international listeners in particular, because you probably don't know a lot of these actors and where they are placed in other films. Now, Blaster was played by Paul Larson. And believe it or not, he's been in every single Mad Max film. In the first one, he was the mentally impaired farmhand on that little bit of property where they basically rest after the tow cutter is chasing them. So you'll probably remember that he scares Max's wife. And that's basically the hand. And in Mad Max 2, Kevin and Kyle, can you pick where he was?
Oh, Mad Max 2, I don't know. I'm going to guess he probably had his head covered as well. I don't know.
Yeah, that would be my guess too. I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Okay. In the main scene where we see basically the hordes coming to the fuel gas town, basically, you actually see them tied to the front of the car that the main villain is riding in. So you can actually see there's two. And he's strapped to the car, a little bit like in Fury Road, where Tom Hardy's Max is strapped to the top of the car as well. Now, another character that is a very famous actor plays him out here in Australia is a famous musician, which Aaron will know very well as well. That is, of course, Iron Bar, played by Angry Anderson. And, of course, he is part of a no-hair metal band. Iron Bar is basically the security henchman, if you like, of the picture. But Angry Anderson is a very, very famous Australian rock singer from Rose Tattoo, which is a huge band out here, all through the late 70s and early 1980s. Big personality on TV out here. We also got Robert Grubb playing the Pig Killer. Now, I'm going to let you guys think about a certain war film that Mel Gibson did a few years previous, and this guy's from that.
Is that Gallipoli?
Oh, that's the one, Gallipoli. Yeah. That's right. One of Mel Gibson's mates, particularly when they're going into those scenes in, I think it's just before they go to Gallipoli itself, and they're walking through and the British officers come, oh, here we go, oh, parley, oh, yes, here we go. And then the guys that come through in the little hats and the little horses and take the Mickey out of the British officers. Very good friends of course, Mel Gibson's character from when they first sign up for the Australian Army. He's a very well-known personality out here in Australia and played a lot of roles like that. And, of course, going right down to some of the other actors you're going to find through, like Justin Clarke, huge out here in Australia through the 1980s through to the 1990s, very famous over in the UK too because of some of those shows that we just don't watch here in Australia and we just like Foster's Beer, throw over to the UK. So we're going to jump through now, of course, to the discussion points. But a lot of these cast members, again, are members that you're going to find in a lot of Australian films of that period. Guys, do you have anything to add before we jump into that?
I just wanted to mention a couple of the other cast members. I loved Angerson as Iron Bar. The look that he had where he had that pole coming behind him with that wig and that weird kind of face mask behind him. Very imposing. I like how you think that he's dead first off when Mad Max throws him over the balcony of Tina Turner's little, house up there. But he always keeps coming back. I love that. The guy that I really like too, though, is Edwin Hodgman, who plays Dr. Dealgood. He's like the showman that is introducing the fight inside the Thunderdome, and the way that he talks to people. And there's that one scene where the camera comes in on his face when he says, two men enter, one man leaves, and he's such a good showman. And then, of course, we've got to touch on the main female lead here, Helen Boudet as Savannah Nix, who is the leader of the tribe child survivors. Very distinctive face. I thought she was she was pretty in that way. And when she starts telling the story of the pilot and everything like that, very, very, very good cadence in the way that she did that. What about you, Kyle? Any of those characters stand out for you?
I would have to say, first of all, Iron Bar is such a unique look. And the fact that, how many times has he escaped death in this film? But and you hit it on the head, the importance of Savannah Nix, and played by Helen Boudet, is incredibly important. And it's really, really, she's the voice of the children. So, yeah, I would agree with those two very much so.
Without a doubt. I think that, look, a lot of the casting on this was probably the strongest out of this original trilogy of Mad Max, wouldn't you say?
Definitely, yeah, because I think more of the characters stood out in their own unique way. I think that all the films had characters that stood out, but this had a lot. This really did. And especially in their looks really were all very unique as well. And one of the things that lended to a few of the great things about this film.
Yeah, definitely. Kyle, your thoughts?
Very much what Kevin said. This film is, and this world is so unique. And I think everybody who they ever brought into it brought that their own uniqueness to this film, knowing they were going into this world. And I think that's one of the things that just makes all these films stand out. But yeah, I think in this particular case, even more so because of just how outrageous Bartertown was. And I really think that influenced a lot of the characters in Bartertown.
All right. So we're going to be going through some of our own thoughts on this amazing film, what made it great, and what the opportunities in this film are. Where does it fall down, and what would you do? What would you, you're George Miller, how do you change it? How do you make it more exciting? So let's start with you, Kyle. What did you like about the plot? Give me one positive, and then give me an opportunity, something you'd like to change to make it the Mad Max film you'd make.
I think everything in the first half of the film, but everything with Bartertown is absolutely excellent. I would find a way to make the second half. I understand the point of the second half of the film, but I would find a way to shorten down the stuff with the kids, get a quicker explanation on that, and maybe extend the storyline of them going back into Bartertown, escaping from there and that. But that would be my one change, is just find a way to speed that section of the film up.
I agree with Kyle on that. I think that the kids should probably have been more of a subplot. I think that in addition to the kids, maybe there could have been another town not make less kids. You know, they say, you know, don't work with animals and kids in movies. That's like an old story. If you're going to have a story about kids, the whole movie's got to be about the kids. In this instance, it should have been less about the kids and more about the surrounding world. And so obviously I would agree with Kyle. I would have changed that. I love the train chase scene at the end. I thought that was really, really cool. I could have used a little more blood and guts though. You know, the thing that I will give this film that I did love the plot about it is I got a payoff of what else is happening in other parts of the world when it comes to big cities. What happened to the cities? And I love the fact that we get to fly over in the plane with the kids and the pilot looking over a former city, and now it's kind of a ghost town, which explains something really big, whether it was a, you know, nuclear war or whatever it has been. That I love the way that ended. And I would have still kept that. I just would have changed something regarding the children, made it less about the children.
I agree. Yeah, to me, this is how I would do it. I think the film works as it is, because I've always thought, I'm a little bit like you guys. I'm thinking the second half doesn't work, and it doesn't. You're right. You get through the first bit, and look, the key thing is I would change this. Leave the kids' structure as is, but that third part is where we've got to really look at it. They allude to it that, you know, you got this new environment, a ghost town to look at. I think that's the third part that we're missing. So we're going to move now to soundtrack. Now, the soundtrack itself is amazing. And, of course, one of the things that we really take away is the songs performed by Tina Turner and, of course, the actual soundtrack itself, the score. But I think the great thing is we had Maurice Jarre come in and do the score itself. And those scenes really, I think, when it's used in the film, are sparingly done very well. But Tina Turner's We Don't Need Another Hero and One of the Living, those two songs are enigmatic. So, Kyle, tell us about your thoughts on Tina Turner.
Again, as I said earlier, this was pretty much at one of the biggest heights of Tina Turner's career during the 80s. And We Don't Need Another Hero is an all-time song, period. It's on almost all of her collection's greatest hits. It's on other Motown, Capitol Records greatest hits albums. You can play that song to any generation now. They're going to know that song, and they're going to most likely associate it with Mad Max. And it was such a brilliant song to go with the marketing of the film. And really, I think it's one of the, when you add in the fact that really, I think of her career and all the amazing things Tina Turner has done in her career, I do think Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome is one of the standout highlight moments of her career when you add in the fact that this song goes with it. And I think that's what makes Tina Turner just so memorable coming out of this film and in this moment in her career.
I agree with everything that Kyle said. Tina was on top of the world during this time, and she has so many hits. And, you know, when she broke off on her own and went solo, it was the best thing that could have happened for her. And being highlighted in a anticipated American back film with a hero like Mad Max, it was the perfect platform to even have her stardom go even higher. And she's got a very distinctive voice when she sings and when she talks, and the costume, their costume people did a great job highlighting her in every shot and what she wore. And she had some great lines in this film too. And, you know, if you look at a lot of the camera shots, a lot of the camera shots are below kind of looking up at her. And I love that as well, because it makes her very imposing. And I love seeing her during that one scene where you see her coming down from her high top little hideout on that chair, sliding down to the Thunderdome. What an entrance, man. If anyone can pull that off, Tina Turner could. And regarding the music, it really, really lended to the soundtrack. It lended to the feel of the film. And it's just, those are just, We Don't Need Another Hero is probably one of her biggest hits. And, you know, it charted one in Canada, two in the US, and three in England. So you know how big that song was worldwide. Now, Now, Adam, you have a little different perspective on the fandom of Tina Turner when this movie came out, which I found fascinating, and I thought that you should share that.
So Tina Turner, out here in Australia, became such synonymous with football, music, and of course, one of the things is commercial music. A lot of the time past this, once the film clip for We Don't Need Another Hero came out, there was a number of different ones that came out here in Australia around 1985, which were soundtracks and stuff. This went straight to number one out here in Australia, particularly on Countdown, which is our big one out here at the time, and, of course, all over. But one of the great things is she got picked up by the TV stations, which were doing a lot of things like NRL, which is our rugby out here. And she did simply the best, one of the most catchy songs you could ever hear, as the theme song for a number of years running, and then came back after years of being back in the States with other different projects, came and did another one for us out here in Australia. And, of course, we had Friday Night, Great at the Football, as another theme out here. So, again, we are known, we've known her through football circles and Mad Max circles. So she's really a staple of Australian 80s and 90s television football.
I find that fascinating that your is it Australian rules football, footy? Or is it was it rugby?
Rugby league, yeah.
Yeah, rugby league. I find that fascinating that that she was the voice for that, and that how big that she crossed over in that way. That's really cool.
That's right. And of course, football without shoulder pads. So we're going to be going through the trivia on the film now, guys. One of us is going to do each as we go through. So I'll start with myself, then Kevin, and of course, Kyle. Each of these you can find on IMDb and other sources. Again, always go and find out different things through film, through trivia, because you get a unique perspective. So I'm going to start with George Miller lost interest in the project after his friend and producer Byron Kennedy was killed, obviously, in the car, the helicopter crash while location shouting. So this may explain why Miller only handled action sequences, while George Ogilvy handled the actual casting scenes and stuff like that of the actors themselves. Kevin, you've got one?
Yes, the film was originally not a Mad Max film, but a post-apocalyptic Lord of the Flies, which makes sense because if you're familiar with the book Lord of the Flies, it's about a bunch of kids that rule each other and things don't go well. about a tribe of children who are found by an adult. It becomes the third Mad Max film when George Miller was suggested that Max is a man who finds the children.
Yeah. Something else interesting is Max's eyes are different. The pupil in his left eye is permanently dilated. This is a nod to Mad Max 2 back from 1981 when his car is forced off the road by Wes and Max crashes. He suffers a severe injury to, among other body parts, his left eye. The disparity is easier to see in close-ups and very easy to see in the high-definition versions of the film. In the regular version, it's most prominent when Max first looks down to the on the Thunderdome.
Wow. The sandstorm at the end of the film was actually real, unlike the one in Fury Road, eh? And a camera plane flew into it for some shots. The storm, in its entirety, hit the crew in the desert, forcing them to ride out in their cars and wherever they could find cover.
Ooh, that must have been rough. Now, this is I love this because if you don't remember, the possible outcomes on the Wheel of Death, of course, that was in the scene of, after Thunderdome, where Max decides not to kill Blaster, the Wheel of Death will say what his he's sentenced to. And I love this. It says the options are death, okay, hard labor, acquittal, gulag, auntie's choice, spin again, forfeit goods, underworld, amputation. And life imprisonment. So if there really is only two, I guess, get out of free jail cards here, one is acquittal and spin again. Auntie's choice, I'm sure, isn't going to be either of those. Let me ask you, Kyle, If you can't get acquittal and you can't get spin again, which one of these would be the one you would choose out of all these, if you had a choice?
I'm thinking forfeit goods.
Forfeit goods, yeah. Oh, you can take the easy way out. What about you, Adam?
I'm going to go with Tina. Auntie's choice.
Auntie's choice. Yeah, you make sure you want to suck up to her first before you do that. I'm kind of wondering what goulash is. That's what
Mel Gibson got on the wheel.
Okay. That's the one that sent him out to the desert, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna. What about Underworld? Is that where all the pig poop is?
Yeah. Poop party.
The poo party. Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna go with forfeit goods. I don't want to lose amputation. Maybe I'll just keep choosing spin again until it hits on the one that I want. I don't know.
Wheel of Fortune. All right, Carl, next.
Max's name is only spoken once in the movie. Just after he meets Master Blaster in the underworld, Master says, "Who you?" Max replies, "Me, Max."
The script called for Art Entity to drive a vehicle. Now, all of the vehicles were built using manual transmissions, which Tina Turner couldn't drive. So a car equipped with an automatic transmission had to be constructed.
That's so American. Yeah. You know, because we're so used to automatic transmissions out here. There's a lot of us now that aren't used to manuals. So that's interesting. Tina Turner's steel male dress weighed more than 121 pounds or 55 kilograms for you guys outside of the States. 121 pounds. That's amazing. That is heavy.
Now, you know what that proves, Kevin?
What's that?
Of all these big, tough men that were on this set, Tina Turner was still the most badass on the set.
This is true. Yeah, her stuff apparently weighed the most.
George Miller was given the rights to Mad Max 2 in this film to get him to step aside as the director of Contact. Very interesting. I did not know that.
This is the Jodie Foster film?
Yeah, the 1997 film Contact.
So that means this film was in possible production like a lot earlier than, you know, came out like 10 years later, apparently.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's crazy. Tina Turner had to shave her head for her wig to actually fit properly. She had no problems with that.
Interesting. Yeah. In interviews about Mad Max 2 in 81, George Miller said that while Max's world was after the collapse of the social, political, economic system we know now, it was not post-World War III. However, per Dr. Dealgood's introduction in the Thunderdome, this film is explicitly set after a war, though not necessarily World War III. So that's interesting. If it's not World War III, when we expect post-apocalyptic movies to have a world war effect, was this then just in like the southern region, or was it only in Australia? This is interesting.
I think it's always been one of the big questions of the Mad Max universe.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So. Did Motley Crue come up with that character name? Dr. Dealgood.
As we talked about earlier, the poster art for this film was the last one done by Richard Amsel before he passed away. And again, I just have to reiterate, that's such a major loss because he was such a talent.
He was apparently, when I was looking up how old he was, he was only like about 41 years old when he passed away. So life taken too soon.
Very much so. Tina Turner's character is billed, obviously, as Auntie Entity, but nowhere in the film does anyone call her that. She's also referred to as just Auntie.
Nah. I'm going to jump down a little bit here because I touched on this earlier, and I want to talk about this. Jedediah's plane is a Transavia PL-12 air truck. That's spelled AIRTRUK, a single-engine agricultural biplane designed by Transavia in Australia, first flown in 1965. Around 120 had been built by the time this movie was made. That's not a lot, but it is a very distinctive plane. I've never seen anything like that before.
Oh, I have.
I bet.
Yeah.
You guys have weird vehicles. I love it.
Yeah. I find this one mind-blowing because talk about completely changing a movie. Jane Fonda was considered for the Auntie Entity part.
Wow. I can't imagine her in that.
I can't imagine anybody but Tina Turner in that role at this point.
The film references a novel by Russell Hoban called Ridley Walker about a hero traveling in post-apocalyptic England. Didn't know that one.
Ah. This I thought was interesting was casting director Alison Barrett scoured Australian schools for the tribe of 60 kids from 20 months to 16 years old.
Wow.
Now here's one for the butchers and all of us. There were 600 pigs in Underworld. Buying that many could have hurt the pork market, so they rented them from a pig farmer.
Isn't that crazy? So, folks, today we've covered one of the most, I'd say, commercial post-apocalyptic films out there. And, of course, this is the one that led us to one that we're going to be talking about in the next episode, which is, again, a huge hit. But I think they ragged that R rating back on there and they said, look, let's go. Let's go all out for, you know, the blood, the guts, the action, but the same amount of story and commercial concerns that this film was going to do. But before we get into our final thoughts in closing, I've got to say we need to have a little bit of a chat about this amazing channel. Kevin, take it away.
Yes, we want to let our listeners know of all the other great shows and programming that we have on the Fandom Podcast Network. So please check out our FPNet promo.
Hey, Kevin, I hear you're one of the Fandom Podcast Network's co-founders.
I heard the same rumor about you too, Kyle. Like the Three Musketeers, we would be incomplete without our third member and co-founder, Norman.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's an honor to be part of the Fandom Podcast Network with you two. Kyle, why don't you start us off and let everyone know what great shows we have on the network.
Absolutely. Starting with our flagship show on the network, we have Culture Clash, your weekly fandom news show covering everything, news, reviews, and whatever crazy things we can come up with. Of course, we also have Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast with Tom Caldwell, Brandon Shematula, and Chris High. Kevin, what else do we have on the network?
Kyle, we also have Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. Also, if you're a hard rock music fan, I host the Hair Metal podcast as we rediscover the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. Norman, we're not done yet. What else have we got on the Fandom Podcast Network?
Well, Kevin, you and I co-host Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast covering all things Highlander. And I also co-host with you, Kevin, and Kyle, and other special guests, Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery, and the Orville podcast. But Kyle, last, and certainly not least, what are the other shows on the network?
Well, for all you movie fans out there, this podcast is for you. We have Couch Potato Theater, covering cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. And for you football fans, we have this show for you, The End Zone, giving you all the great mediocre fantasy football advice you can get and covering everything the NFL. And finally, you Doctor Who fans out there, we have Type 40, a Doctor Who fandom podcast. Now, Kevin, can you tell everyone how to find all these great programs on the Fandom Podcast Network?
Sure, Kyle. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network master feed at the fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and Google Play. You can also find us on Facebook under Fandom Podcast Network. If you'd like to email us, you can email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. We are also on Instagram under Fandom Podcast Network and on Twitter at FanPodNetwork.
Also, please search Fandom Podcast Network on tpublic.com for our store, where you can find all our shows and their logos and great t-shirts and other fun items. Also, please search Fandom Podcast Network on iTunes and leave us a review.
Thank you so much for listening and supporting the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and most importantly, enjoy your fandom.
So, you can catch this amazing channel's work here with Culture Clash, the weekly fandom show, Blood of Kings, the Highlander podcast, Discoville podcast, the Star Trek Discovery and Orville podcast, and of course, Couch Potato Theater, favorite movies you don't get often off the couch for. You'd stay in home and watch. Of course, Time Warp, celebrating our favorite fandoms of the past. And of course, Good Evening, Alfred Hitchcock podcast with co-hosts Tom Caldwell, Brandon Shematula, and of course, Chris Hay, The End Zone, the NFL podcast, Type 40, a Doctor Who's podcast with Dan Hadley, Norman Lau, and of course, Carl Wagner, and of course, the Hair Metal podcast, celebrating nostalgia of 80s metal with co-host Kevin Reitzel. And I've got to say, I've listened to a couple episodes now, thanks to Kev's heads up on some of those, especially LA Guns.
Mm-hmm.
Not know the background. So you've got to check that out, guys. It's awesome.
Yeah, fun show. It's one of those itches I had to scratch, and it's nice to know other people feel the same.
Definitely. Any news too, Kyle, on upcoming shows that could be coming possibly to Couch Potato Theater in the sands of the universe?
Gee, could you be hinting at a little self-promotion project that you're working on? I'm feeling the spice in the air. I might need to do a little fishing. Anybody got any worms? Dune is coming soon to Couch Potato Theater. We're going to be talking the books. We're going to be talking the original movie from the 80s. We're also going to be talking about the miniseries that both Dune and Children of Dune that aired on the Sci-Fi Channel. And we might even drop a few hints about the upcoming Dune remake from Denis Villeneuve, who, of course, brought us The Arrival.
That's right. The podcast will flow. The podcast will flow. All right, let's get back to the film itself. So final thoughts, Kevin. Your final thoughts on this amazing trilogy, Kappa?
You know, I got to say, you know, when I'm in a Mad Max mood, I will watch all these films back to back. And, you know, I do feel there's a little part of Mad Max 3 here, Beyond Thunderdome, that you know, is kind of like, the kids. But you know what? I will fast forward through that part because I love the first half. I love the return to Bartertown. Bartertown was just a great set. I love even the train chase. I like the fact that they did something a little bit different by having your Mad Max chase, you know, and I love the fact that it was on a train. I love train heist movies. I love action scenes around trains. But to me, what really kind of saved this film for me was the train chase scene. And then of course getting, as I touched on earlier, the look at the cities and seeing other than just desert and wasteland. It was nice to see, you know, a metropolis wasteland instead. And so I give it for that. And I got to tell you, the costumes are fantastic in this film. They felt like a little more was put into it than just kind of going to, you know, S&M shops and buying weird stuff from, you know, sports stuff and putting costumes together, which looked great. Don't get me wrong, but it was nice to see a little more into the costumes and such. And I liked even some of the vehicles. I prefer the vehicles probably Mad Max 1 and 2, but there were still some cool vehicles, especially that one guy that had the car that, you know, had the pattern of a cow. And then he had the outfit too. I thought that guy was great looking.
And Carl, your thoughts?
The most commercial of all of the Mad Max films, yet probably in a lot of people's mind, the least of the Mad Max films. Again, some amazing, iconic things in this film. Two men enter, one man leave. The Thunderdome, the looks, everything. I think this, of all the Mad Max films, was the one that, when Fury Road came out, got the biggest boost from Fury, the success of Fury Road, people revisiting this film and maybe seeing it when they were younger, not completely understanding what was going on and seeing it now and going, oh, wait a minute. And I think when you look, go back from where we started with the original Mad Max film through this one, capping this at the time, what we thought was just going to be a trilogy, it really is, like I talked about earlier, the story of a man going through the cycle of horrific events, losing himself, and yet coming back to his own humanity. And finding hope in a desolate wasteland. And I think it reflects where George Miller was at the time. And yes, you look at this film and where George Miller's emotional state was in this film, you can tell he wasn't as interested in doing this film as he was with the original Mad Max and Road Warrior 2. But I think that's one of the reasons why this film also has such a different feel from it, from those movies. And I think there's so many things that you can still pull out from this and within the history of cinema. This is a must-see film, and I think something that you appreciate more as you get older and you have a better understanding of everything that's kind of under the undercurrent of the wasteland and post-apocalyptic life that is the Mad Max films.
I'm of the same feeling. You know, this movie's always been my least favorite for years, and I think it's only in the last probably 5 or 6 years once it was released on Blu-ray in particular, really revisited it and sat down and like made my peace with what the film was trying to do, and then saw how smart the movie is. The fact that we don't have a bad guy. We don't have, you know, a real action set piece towards the end of the film like we do in the others. This is more about survival and actually finding life. That's what the actual film's about. It's about actually setting out and finding society again. Although I do feel, as you said, Kevin, you know, that we get to that point where, you know, we've got this society that we do see, this ghost town out there, and the cities, I think, should have been a third act explored in the film itself.
Yeah, and I don't know if it – let me ask you guys this before we wrap things up here. When I see this movie, I see a lot of parallels with the movie Waterworld. You know, and obviously Waterworld, you could say, is inspired from the Mad Max films. But there's something about this film, Beyond Thunderdome, and what you get from The Wasteland, and then you get the kind of flipped version. Instead of The Wasteland, you get The Waterland. But there's still this in that you got out of the second Mad Max film, you got people wanting to try to find a better life somewhere. Whether it's, you know, the second film where you get the rumor that there's this beautiful coastline, they want to get to that. Where in Waterworld, you get a similar thing here. You want to get out of the water, you need to find land, and you need to, you know, find what's left there and try to find food and agriculture out of that way. And, but people still adapting to the current, you know, horrible hand that they're dealt. And, you know, so I thought, do you guys get that parallel between those two movies?
Oh yeah. I think you can definitely see that. I think a lot of things in Mad Max were probably inspiration for Waterworld with the obvious twist. I actually think though of the two, Waterworld might actually be the more depressing side of it, where maybe there's not as much hope as there was in Mad Max, because in Mad Max, you always had that feeling there was something out there for hope. And you, towards the end of Waterworld, you really didn't have that feeling anymore that this was it. And I think that's something that, you know, I think maybe the end of Thunderdome, and I agree with Adam that I wish they would have done some time to explore one of these cities as a third act. Shorten that up. And I think that would have really changed how we saw this film. But, you know, I think a lot of films have been inspired by this, but I think Waterworld is definitely, there's a lot of parallels between these films and Waterworld that you can have.
I totally agree. On the next episode, and this is the final episode of Maximum Couch Potato, we're going to be joining Tom Hardy's Mad Max and, of course, the Doof Warrior. That's right, the Doof. We're bringing the Doof to Fandom Podcast Network. And we're going to be talking about the amazing universe of one amazing villain, Immortan Joe, Immortar. That's right. We're going to be talking about this series, Kappa. This is a reboot. Is it just a sequel? Is this maybe the kid? That's right, the kid from Mad Max 2. We'll have all those sorts of things for you in the next and final episode talking about Mad Max Fury Road. So in closing, I would like to thank both Kevin, the Raider Nerd, Russell, and of course, Carl Wagner, the co-founders of this amazing channel, for having us here for Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Thank you so much, fellas.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it. I always love talking Max and looking forward to Fury Road, man. Appreciate it.
Yep. Definitely looking forward to Fury Road. And I just have to close out this podcast by saying, me, Kyle.
Three men enter, one man leaves.
Me, Kyle.
And that's a wrap, boys.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this third episode of Maximum Couch Potato on Fandom Podcast Network's Couch Potato Theater. Join us in the next month and a half as we look at Fury Road, 2015's amazing award-winning film. That's right, got many Academy Awards, this amazing ride. Because that's really what this film is. Fury Road is one massive on-the-road chase. Of course, it's got an amazing story, amazing cast of characters, and a new Mad Max. And of course, we have Furiosa, played by Charlize Theron as well, which is really the true star of that amazing film. So go out there, go and check out the film, watch it, and get ready for our look at this amazing film. This is one that hopefully will have many sequels very, very soon. Go and check out Fandom Podcast Network on all the contact links we gave out, and we'll catch you next month on Maximum Couch Potato.